Alcoholic Boyd Watkins. You might want to wait till after I talk to you, see if you want to still thank me. I apologize to the elder statesman that I'm not wearing a coat and tie. It's very hot. Normally in the summertime at an AA meeting, you'll see me in shorts and flip-flops. So I'm not in shorts and flip-flops, so I did step it up a little bit. What I'm supposed to do is tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. That's like the general thing that you hear in the big book. Somewhere else it says, in the personal story section, each member, in their own words and from their own point of view, tells how they formed their own relationship with God. And that's a little more, I guess, accurate to what happened. That is not what I was looking for when I got sober, when I got to AA. But that is kind of what has happened. I'm going to try to get sober pretty quick. Everybody knows how to get drunk, I guess. And I have a bad habit of staying drunk too long, so I'm going to go ahead and get started. My home group is the Piedmont Group. We meet Tuesday nights at 7 a.m. and Friday nights at 8 p.m. at 1510 West Cone Boulevard. For Tuesday, we do a beginner's big book meeting, and on Friday nights, we do a moderated step discussions / speaker meeting. And it's been my home group the whole time I've been sober. I've had a couple other extra home groups where a home group is one where I'm accountable, and most importantly, it's where I can be of service. It's where I can do something to help. My sobriety date is June the 6th of 1996. I got sober on D-Day. That was not my first sobriety date. I hope it's my last, because I don't think I probably got another drunk in me. I don't know if I got another recovery. By the time I had surrendered, I was way overqualified for Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't realize that at the time. Growing up, my dad was an alcoholic. My mom was an unrecovering Al-Anon. And so I got to see what an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic looked like. And this is how that went down. Dad would drink every night until he went to sleep. And mom, every night, would have two drinks. She'd put about that much of whatever, gin or vodka normally, and about that much mixer. And even when I was a little kid, that mixture just didn't make sense to me. There wasn't enough booze in it, and I never drank. So I think I had alcoholism a long time before I ever drank alcohol. I really do, because it's a disease of perception. It's always been, for me, that I don't see things clearly, and I see things in a warped perspective, for lack of a better word. And I had that before I ever drank. But growing up, I saw what active alcoholism was like. And I don't blame my mom and dad for my alcoholism. I did when I got sober. Well, I was mad at them, blamed them for a lot of stuff that I later discovered they had nothing to do with. I also arrived here with the God of my misunderstanding, because I did believe there was a God, but I was very angry at God. I believed in him. I sure as heck didn't think he believed in me. And I also blamed him for a lot of things that I later discovered that he had nothing to do with. So there were times in the household, we never had people over, because never knew how Dad was going to be. I didn't like bringing friends over. But the weird thing is my mom and dad were really, really good people. And my dad was really the greatest man I've ever known personally. He really was. He gave me a lot of good values, and so did my mom. They were both good people. They were just sick. I didn't understand that, and I think that was why I was so angry. That's one thing this program helped me to do, because when I got here, I couldn't separate my dad from the disease. This program helped me to separate my dad from the disease, and it also helped to separate me from the disease, because when I got here, I just thought I was no good. I thought I was a POS. That's what I thought I was. I thought there was just something wrong with me. And there is. I got alcoholism. But thank God that's treatable. When I was 15, I got enough alcohol in me to feel the effects. Now, up until that point, I just never felt like I fit in. You hear this from the podium all the time. I just felt different. I'd look at people, and I would go, man, they seem like they've got it all together, and I don't know. I'm just out of sorts. I don't know what to do. There's a term that I learned here. I was comparing my insides to other people's outsides. And it's kind of like I later found out, even towards the end of my drinking, I could kind of clean up and you know, put on some nice clothes and put on a mask, and I could go out and act normal. And, you know, I got that a lot when I got sober. You weren't that bad. I didn't know you drank that much. And they didn't. They didn't see that. They saw, I like how the book puts it. It says the alcoholic is like an actor that we present to the world, a stage character, and we want to enjoy a certain reputation, but we know in our hearts that we don't deserve it. And that was me. I was always trying to play the role I thought I needed to play, that the people that I were around at the time would accept me, hopefully like me, optimally, give me what I wanted, whatever that may be. It never really occurred to me to just be myself. And that's another gift that AA gave me. I can be myself today. And I couldn't do that before. I really couldn't. I didn't know how to. When I was 15, though, I got a hold of some alcohol. I stole a bottle of Cutty Sark Scotch. That ain't a good first drink. But I had access to it, so I stole this bottle of Cutty Sark Scotch, and a friend of mine and I took it, and we went out in the woods and drank it. God, I took a sip of that. It was awful. I don't think I've, to this day, tasted anything worse. But I'm going to drink it. I got willpower. We got willpower. Alcoholics definitely got willpower. I don't know of a stronger-willed group of people with more willpower than people in AA. Unfortunately, trying to use willpower on the disease is like trying to use willpower on diarrhea. I mean, you get about the same result. Well, at least I did. But anyway, I jump around a lot. So I drank enough to feel the effects of the alcohol. I just gutted it down. I don't know how much I drank. But what happened was, and I like what Bill says in his story. He says, I discovered alcohol. I don't think non-alcoholics discover alcohol. I think that we do. Because it's just that warm feeling came over me. I heard one old-timer, he talked about it, felt like an umbrella opening up inside of him. And it was just like all that self-concern and being self-conscious and not being good enough and always comparing myself. The book says we're egomaniacs with inferiority complexes, and that really was me. I would either look down at you or I would look up at you. I didn't really look at many people eye to eye. Maybe the folks in the bar after I'd had about three or four. That would level me out and I'd feel a part of. That's what booze did for me, and that's what it did for me that first time. And I puked and got sick and didn't get in any trouble, but something happened to me. And like I said, my mom wasn't an alcoholic and had two drinks every night, and I remember asking her, why do you only have two drinks? Because I saw what Dad did. She said, well, after a couple of drinks, I start to feel it. And again, before I'd ever had a drink, that didn't make any sense to me. And my grand sponsor says this. Alcoholics or a non-alcoholic will drink two drinks and stop because they feel like they're losing control. An alcoholic will drink two drinks and continue because they feel like they're gaining control. And that was news to me when I got here. By the time I'd reached AA, I knew I was an alcoholic. I really didn't know what that meant, though. I mean, hell, when I was in college, I was in an informal fraternity. I was in two informal fraternities. One was Alcoholics Unanimous, and the other was Sigma Lambda Pi, smoke a lot of potta. Yeah, that was my identity. So... You know, early on, I had a lot of fun drinking and drugging. I did. I pretty much all did everything you can imagine. The only thing I never did was mainline heroin or coke. Other than that, name it, I probably did it. And when I first got here, that was one of the things I think that separated me, which is what the disease tends to do. I would compare myself, and I would listen to people, and I would I'd read the big book, and I'd try to find out how I was different. And this old Yankee woman who I loved to death, when I was new, and she was a home group member at Piedmont, would come up to me and go, don't compare, don't compare. And she kept doing that to me. She could see I was doing that. You know, and that's the disease. It wants me to do that. It wants me to do that today. Anyway, my drinking career was pretty standard. You know, I didn't drink much from that first drink until 21. smoked a lot of pot, did a lot of other stuff, drank alcohol when I could. The whole purpose of all of that was to change the way I felt, because unaided with any substance or chemical, I didn't like how I felt. I was restless and irritable and discontent. And when I had a few drinks, I would get that sense of ease and comfort. And I don't know. I didn't get in a lot of trouble early on. When I was 21, two things happened. A, I could buy alcohol, liquor, legally. Two, my dope dealer moved out of town. So, and I discovered alcohol. And I like the other stuff too, but booze is what took me where I wanted to go. It really did. When I first started out, three beers could get me a buzz. Then it was six-pack. Then once I started drinking liquor, at the end of my drinking, and again, please try not to compare. I hope you can see the similarities, because that's recovery. And I wanted to say this too. The nicest compliment anybody ever gave me in an AA meeting, somebody who I have an enormous amount of respect for came up to me after a meeting, and she said, "You're a clear channel." And I hope I am tonight. I ask God to help me be that, do that. And I want you to understand, none of this is what I'm saying is original. I learned it here. If I could have got sober on my own, I wouldn't be here. I can't. Dr. Silkworth says we hang together or we die separately. That was my experience, because I almost died separately after going through treatment. So, but my drinking increased. The consequences increased. I tried to keep people at arm's length. My character defects were really good for that. I had a job where I didn't have a lot of direct supervision. People say that, I can't remember how it's put, but basically my goals were set by, my drinking set my goals. I did not want to get in a place where anything would interfere with my drinking. And so those were the choices I made as I went on. In 95, October 95, typical day, I came to about 4:30, I think, and I was shaking, and I needed a shave, so I sat on the edge of my bed, and I poured about that much Jim Beam in a cup, a glass, and about that much Pepsi or Coke. I sat there and set it on the nightstand, and I lit a cigarette up, got my courage up, and took it and took a mouthful of it and swallowed it, because I knew I needed to do that if I was going to be able to shave, because I had the shakes. And this had been going on for a while. This wasn't the first time I'd done this. And the nausea, you know, I'm trying to spit it back out, and sweat's popping off of me. And some mornings, I couldn't hold it down, and I'd spit it back right back in the glass. I'm going to waste the alcohol. But I'd eventually get it down, and I did that day. So I got where I could quit shaking. I got up, and I went to shave. Shaved, took a shower. And when I came out, my mom, my sisters, somebody I did not recognize, and a friend of mine were sitting in my living room. And I said, "Why are you guys here?" They said, "This is an intervention." I said, "What's that?" They said, "Sit down, we'll tell you." And they did. Each in their turn told me. There was a lot of tears. And they told me what my alcoholism had been doing to them. And I was kind of, I really thought, I ain't hurting anybody. I'm just drinking. And, you know, like, my mom was waiting for a call from the cops that I was dead in a drunk driving accident or something like that. She lost sleep over that. My sisters cried because I hadn't been around. I hadn't been there. I hadn't been a good brother, and I hadn't been there for them. And they said, "Hey, we got you a place at Fellowship Hall. Are you willing to go?" I didn't really want to go, but I did. And I went out to Fellowship Hall, and that was October 18th, I believe, of 95. And got my $10,000 big book. That's what it cost back then. And I thought I was ready, and it didn't work. I was unwilling to surrender. I thought I was. I really did. And I listened to them, and I kind of did what they asked me to do. But in my head, it's like I was comparing, and it was like, I'm different. That's the disease. And so I got out of there, and they said, when you get out, go to a meeting. I said, oh, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. And I got out of there, and I started thinking. I thought, you know, I've been in treatment for 28 days. I'm going to take a rest. I'm going to take a day off, and I'll go tomorrow. And so I didn't go the day I got out. I did go the next day. But the bottom line was I'm going to run my recovery. You don't know me. I'm smart, and I can figure it out. And I think of the insanity of that, because by that time, I mean, my life sucked. Financially, I wasn't doing well. Emotionally, I wasn't doing well. Spiritually, I wasn't doing well. At the end of my drinking, there were three people that were crazy enough to still drink with me. I was absolutely miserable. And the only relief I would get is maybe the 10 or 20 minutes when I first started drinking. And then I would just continue to drink, because by that time, I'm not drinking to go out and party. That's what I thought I was doing. I drank alone. If I drank in public, bad stuff happened. And it's not good, because I was a blackout drunk with no memory. And so as my drinking progressed, I would get the call. Now, when I was like at college, it was like, hey, man, you remember what you did last night? And it was funny. But at the end, I would get that call. Man, do you remember what you did last night? And it wasn't funny anymore. And I was ashamed. And again, I didn't understand what I had. I didn't know what alcoholism was. I didn't understand that it was a spiritual malady and that I am physiologically, physically different than a non-alcoholic. And the best cure treatment that's ever been found for this disease is Alcoholics Anonymous, which is a spiritual solution, not religious. Because I had a lot of preconceived notions and a lot of prejudices when I got here. And it's like when they said, turn your life over to God's will. I'm like, ooh, what the hell does that mean? I thought I'd end up being like a televangelist or something, or, I don't know, shaving my head and having to sell flowers in the airport, you know. Or maybe I would end up in the Himalayas beside the Dalai Lama. I mean, that's really what I remember having those thoughts. And because, you know, I'm so unique. So, anyway, I got out of there, and I wasn't willing to surrender. And I went to some meetings. They said go to three. I think they wanted you to go do 4 a week, and I did 4 a week. 3.5 weeks later, I got drunk again. Then I got to go to Butner in handcuffs, and that is fun. Butner is the nut house down by Raleigh that, if you ain't got any money, that's where they lock you up when you are involuntarily committed, which my family did. Thank God they had gone to some Al-Anon meetings, and they had kind of gotten wise. And I got out of there, and I remember getting the call from them. They said, look, we've tried to help you, and you're not willing to do anything different. So if you need to go ahead and drink and die, then you go ahead and drink and die. But please stay away from us, because we don't want to watch it anymore. And I remember being so angry at them. How dare they? And I had no clue. Just at that point, had no inkling of what I had done. And I think in recovery, my awareness of all this stuff came in digestible chunks. If I'd have gotten it all at once, I probably would have. If the realization of what I had done came all at once. So anyway, I got out of there, and first thing I did when I got out of there was I went and got me a half a gallon of Jim Beam, because by God, if you'd been treated like that, you'd drink too. Now, the truth is, it was just the only solution that I had to make the pain stop, because that was the bottom line. I was just in pain. And the weird thing is I really I'd been sober a while before I started getting an inkling or an understanding of the level of pain that I'd been in and how long I'd been in it. My disease is kind of like if you put a frog in a pan of boiling water, they will jump right out. But you can put a frog in a pan of cool water, and you can turn the heat up real slow, and the frog will just lay in there, and he'll boil to death not knowing he's dying. And that was kind of how my drinking was. No clue. So I got out of there. I think I actually started making an attempt to get sober maybe in January of 96. I would go to meetings, and I remember it was, I think, in February. Or it might have been January. We had an ice storm here, and it was Friday night, and I was really feeling bad. And I got in my old beat-up car, and I drove to Piedmont through the ice storm because I needed a meeting. There were five people there. I believe two of them are in this room tonight. And something changed there. I think they were willing to make more of an effort to try to help me, because up until that point, I wanted you to help me. But it's like this egomaniac with an inferiority complex. It's either like, help me, please, I can't do anything, or I don't need any help, I got this all figured out. You don't know me. And nothing in between. But they saw that I was making an effort, and so they became more willing, I think, to help me. Up until that point, I was still kind of like, stay the hell away from me, please. I'm going to come here because I'm real smart, and I'm going to learn this program because I'm smart, and I can figure this out. And I can do it my way. I don't have to do it like you idiots do. And it took me a long time to realize that this is not an educational program. It is an experiential program. The book says, if you want what we have, do what we do. It doesn't say, think like we think, learn what we learned. It took me a long time to get that. So I started trying to get sober, and I had 30 days sober on, it was February the 4th, and I'm watching State and Duke play basketball in my apartment, and my phone rings, and it's my mom. She says, I think I'm having a heart attack. And she was. So I went over there, called the ambulance, and she went to the hospital. And thank God I was 30 days sober. She died February 18th. I had 45 days sober. And I drank after that because my sobriety date is June the 6th. Because I needed something to deal with the pain. And all I was doing at that point was I was doing the don't drink and go to meetings. And I heard a speaker say this, don't drink and go to meetings has killed more people than anything said in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I first heard that, I thought, what the hell is he talking about? But it was my experience, because I did the don't drink and go to meetings. I know I went out and got drunk. I went and picked up three 90-day chips one time, somewhere in that period of time. And I got drunk the next day. I went to three different meetings. Look at me, I got a 90-day chip. Look at me. And these people would always say this stuff like, do you have a home group? Who's your sponsor? Are you doing anything to help anybody else other than yourself? And guess what the answers to all of those questions were? And so my last drunk, what I hope is my last drunk, was Memorial Day weekend of 96. And I drank at the pain there after Mom died a few times. But this, I'm a guy I grew up with, played a lot of golf with, I loved to play golf. And his dad had a place up in the mountains, so we were going to go up there and play golf in the mountains and have a good time, like I'd done in the past. I'd gone up there and we had a lot of fun, way back when, before the disease had progressed. The last time I'd gone up there, before this time, I'd really showed my butt, and they hadn't asked me back for a while. And it was one of those, do you remember what you did last night? Not good. It's like there were a lot of people that knew a lot more about my life than I did, because I was in a blackout and I had no memory. I go up there, and this was my thinking. I don't know how many days sober I had at that point. I'm going to a meeting every day. I am. Some days I'm going to two meetings. Didn't have a sponsor, didn't have a home group. All I was doing was going to the meetings. I'm going to learn this. I'm smart. And it just don't work. So I thought, I can drink Thursday night. We'll go up Friday, and I'll drink, and it'll be like old times. And Saturday we'll drink and have a good time and play golf. Sunday I'll taper off, and Memorial Day, Monday, I won't drink. Tuesday, I can go back to meetings, and no one will know. Those were my exact thoughts. So I go up there, and that ain't what happened. Memorial Day, I don't know what day it was. It was May 20-something. And I started drinking up there, showed my butt, got back to Greensboro, and I just started drinking, because by this time, I truly had lost control. I had no control over. Once I started drinking, it was like I'm getting on a roller coaster, and we ain't got any brakes, and I don't know where it's going. And I didn't know this, and I'm in the middle of this. And the thing about it is after going to treatment and finally getting sober, every time I got drunk, I was probably 9 months sober when this I figured this one out, when it occurred to me. Every time I got drunk, I was sitting alone by myself thinking, trying to come up with solutions to my problems like I had always done my entire life. And at that point, I would always circle back to the efforts. Might as well get drunk. We hang together or we die separately. So, one thing I didn't tell you when I went to Butner, the reason they called the cops on me was because I was drunk out of my gourd and I'm running around with a Glock pistol talking about blowing my brains out. And so, that's why I went to Butner. Now, at that point in time, I did not want to commit suicide. I wanted to commit suicide temporarily. That was just the last thing I had to get them off my back. And that's what happened. Well, I'm sitting in my apartment. My last drink was June the 4th. My sobriety date is June the 6th because that's the day I went to a meeting and I picked up a chip. That's the day I surrendered. What happened was, in the interim there was a guy here named Ray Alexander. And Ray Alexander was the embodiment of the principle of attraction rather than promotion. Ray always was nice to me. Ray always stuck his hand out to me. He always made me feel welcome, even when I didn't want him to. And I don't know, probably February, he's like, "You play golf?" Yeah. "You got to play golf with us. We play every Saturday." And he's like that. I think the first time I played golf with him was in March. And I remember I prayed to God, "Oh, God, please help me not embarrass myself." I was so scared. I was just, oh, God, I was just so scared. And I went and played golf. Hit it pretty good that day, actually. And that was the first time I actually saw people in the program as just people. Because we played golf, and they cracked jokes, and a couple of them threw clubs, and told, you know, we had a good time. I'm like, well, these are just like the drunks I play golf with. So up until that point, you were just those AAs. I mean, it just, I saw you people differently. And so I played golf with them when I could. And particularly when I was early in sobriety, it helped a lot. I played golf every Saturday once I got sober because I didn't know what to do when I first got sober. Because on Saturdays, I got drunk. I'd get drunk three times on Saturday. I could come to, drink, pass out, come to, drink, pass out, drink, come to, pass out. That's living, you know, sitting in my apartment by myself. I just think, you know, the misery I was in and the pain I had been in and how long I'd been in it. So I went up and I played golf with this guy, and it didn't work out. I came back here. I started drinking. June 6th, I'm sitting. I hadn't had a drink since the 4th of June. I poured. That's the only time I think I've ever poured alcohol out. There was probably about that much left in a half a gallon, and I poured it out. I physically just had it. I couldn't drink anymore. And that's the way my drinking was at the end. I would drink as hard as I could, as long as I could, until I physically could not. And then I'd lay around in my bed and try to eat something, and maybe a day or two later I could get mobile again. And I wonder how close I really came to death. Probably pretty close. Anyway. Sitting in that apartment, I see this like it was yesterday. I remember it like it was yesterday. Sitting in this chair with that same pistol. And I want to die. Because this is, I think, the problem I had when I first got here. I interpreted this that you're telling me to put down the one thing that I found that makes me feel okay. And for something that I don't believe in or trust. And I just wasn't willing to do that. And when I finally got sober, it wasn't out any virtue. Bottom line was, up until that point, the fear of recovery was greater than the fear of drinking. And I just kept drinking long enough until the fear of recovery was less than the fear of drinking. So I picked the phone up and I called Ray Alexander. Well, I begged God to give me the strength to use the pistol, and I couldn't do it. I used to think I was a coward, and that's why I didn't do it. But I know today that the part of me that wanted to use that gun had nothing to do with the God of my understanding, and the part that wanted me not to use it did. So I put the gun down, and this is what happened. I hung my head, and I said, "God, please help me." And that was the first honest prayer I'd ever said, probably in my life. And I meant it. This was my third step, initial try at it. I sat there a minute, and I said, "F it, I'll do it with them a-holes and AA say for a while. And if it doesn't work, I can always go back and blow my brains out." And I didn't think this was going to work, but I made that decision. And I picked the phone up, and I called Ray Alexander, and I said, "Can you meet me?" And the man did not have time for me that day. He was a lawyer then. He later became a Superior Court judge. I'm just going to get a little political. I'm a conservative. Ray was a Democrat. When he ran for re-election, I went out and hung signs up for him. He's like, I got Boyd to hang a Democrat sign. He'll never do it again in his life. And I called him, and he met me, and I told him the truth. I told him the gut truth, how I really was feeling. And I went to a meeting, and I picked up a chip that night. I cried. I mean, I got honest. I surrendered. And I said, I'm going to go to Bethel tonight and get a start over chip. And I looked awful. He said, that's a big meeting. Maybe you ought to go to a smaller meeting. I said, no. Bethel is where I go on Thursday nights, and Bethel's where I'm going to go and get my chip. Because surrender for me was I was willing to do what you guys said. Up until that point, I wasn't. And J.T. Byrd gave me my last start over chip. And I think the problem I had up until that point was I'd go to AA and I'd listen to you folks and you would make suggestions. At first, I thought you were telling me to do stuff, and nobody's ever told me to do anything. It's my perception, because this is a disease of perception. I didn't get here on a winning streak, but I still thought I could figure it out. This disease it's the darndest thing I've ever seen. I've never seen anything like the disease of alcoholism. Surrender to me was, well, it's kind of like at the end of World War II. They have it's on the battleship Missouri. MacArthur is there, and they've got a table with the surrender documents. The Japanese come out, and they're in top hats and tails, and they walk up to the table where the surrenders is, and the Japanese guy stands there and he's looking at it. And through the interpreter, MacArthur says, what's he doing? And the interpreter tells him, he's reading the terms of surrender. MacArthur said, the surrender is unconditional. He doesn't need to read the terms. He just needs to sign the document. And that's what I did that day. I just surrendered and I gave up. Recovery begins when you become willing to do it someone else's way. And again, up until that point, you people would tell me to do stuff. But if I didn't want to do it, if I didn't understand it, if it didn't make sense to me, if I couldn't figure out what I would get out of it, blah, 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 I wouldn't do it. And after I surrendered that day, that just did not matter. I went to this meeting the next day, and this guy had been trying to help me. I was intimidated by Ray. I didn't ask him to be my sponsor. He was like, there were six guys that helped me when I was new. He was almost like a sponsor because I sure talked to him a lot, and he helped me. He helped me so much. There's four guys that were in that six that helped me. Never able to pay it back. Anyway, this guy who had been trying to help me and offered to sponsor me, and I said, well, I'm still looking, which means I don't want a sponsor. I went up to this guy, and I said, Larry, I can't stop drinking, and I'm going to die. Would you be willing to be my sponsor? He said, sure. I said, I'll do whatever you say. He said, well, I ain't going to tell you to do anything. It ain't my right. It ain't my place. I'll tell you what worked for me, and you can try it. He said, when I first got sober, the first thing I did in the morning was I hit my knees and I asked God to keep me sober. And at night, I thanked him if I managed to stay sober that day. And I remember I immediately went, well, I don't think that'll work. And he didn't jump on me. He just looked at me and said, are you willing to try? And I was for the first time. I hadn't been up until that point because I didn't understand it. It didn't make sense to me, and I did not want to do it. But I was desperate enough to try it. And so I started doing that, and I'm mad at God. I mean, I believe there was one. I was mad at God at that point. So I'm doing this through gritted teeth on my knees by my bed. God, you keep me sober today. I'm doing this because Larry told me to. I ain't drank since. I still do that. Is it odd or is it God? I don't know. The third step, I think, was where I really surrendered, though. People talk about, well, you surrender at one. No, I didn't. I knew I was powerless over alcohol. I'd known that for a long time. I knew my life was unmanageable. I did believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I think I did kind of believe that. You know, I had a problem with that at first, but higher power. Well, you know, I'd been drinking a higher power for years. Because alcohol, Jim Beam was a power greater than myself. The Greensboro Police Department, they were a power greater than myself. Those folks that locked my butt up in Butner, that was a power greater than myself. The Internal Revenue Service, who I owed a lot of money to when I got sober, was definitely a power greater than myself. So I guess somebody said, well, you can choose a different one now. Maybe this one is one that will help you rather than not. So I took the third step, and that was, F it, I'll do what them people say. You know, do what them A-holes in AA say. Don't work, I'm going to blow my brains out. And I'm going to share the story that really helped me with the third step, because that was, I think, the really sticking point for me. It was a lady that used to come out to Fellowship Hall, came out there when I was there. And I don't know how long I'd been sober when I heard her tell the story, but this is when the third step clicked for me. When she went through treatment, she was an atheist. And she did not believe in God. She got out of there, and she was going to meetings. And she was lived in a house with a driveway like this, and it had snowed. So she's getting in her car to go to a 10 a.m. meeting. She got in her car, goes up halfway, hits the snow, comes back down. Does it again, same thing. Does it a third time. As it's coming back down, she said she floored the accelerator. She said, that's my will. And the car slid back down. So then she's an atheist at this point. So she's sitting in the car. She's pissed. She says, all right, I'll try this prayer stuff. But she didn't say stuff. She used another S word. Said, God, I don't think you're there, but if you are there, you know I'm 90 days sober and I'm trying to get to an AA meeting. Don't you think it's time you let me out of my driveway? And she said she laughed. And she sat there a minute and she looked back and saw the dry patch that the car had been sitting on. And she thought, maybe if I get the car back on that, I can get enough momentum to get out of here. So she kind of calmed down, put the car, backed it up on the dry spot, and got out of the driveway. She said it felt like a hand pushed the car up the driveway, and she went on to the meeting. She said that's when she started to understand the third step. On my own, I cannot come up with solutions to problems. When I ask for help from the God of my understanding, something changes, and I'm able to access information that is readily available to me, and I'm able to solve my problems. That just made sense to me. And, you know, God gives us free will. That helped me a lot. He's a gentleman. He won't come in if he's not asked. He, she, it, whatever you believe in. And God, as we understand him, doesn't mean we understand God. Bill Wilson put that in there to say, there's no dogma or doctrine here. You believe whatever you want. That's what they told me. As long as you're willing to believe that there's something bigger than you and that you're willing to listen to something other than this. And I wasn't for a long time. So I just started doing what they asked me to do. I got sober June 6th. In the middle of July, I'm at Radiance. And somebody in this room says, we don't have a chairman for Radiance in August. Why don't you sign up? And I said, okay. I was terrified. Oh, God, I was terrified. I mean, it's like you guys in treatment that came up here and read stuff. Ain't no way you couldn't have gotten me to do that when I was in treatment. Oh, no. I was absolutely terrified. You know, it's weird how this disease is. I was kind of ashamed to be in AA when I first got here. And I was ashamed for anybody to, like, see me praying. You know, see me doing something decent. And I think about that. And the other thing, too, I was worried, like, because I'm in sales. I was worried, like, a client would see me at a meeting and then go tell everybody else and I'd lose all my business. And I said, I can't remember who I said that to. And they said, what do you think they're going to do? Go out there and say, hey, guess who I saw at my AA meeting? That never occurred to me. Anyway, so I chaired Radiance. And they had me chairing somewhere for seven straight months, from August to February. I think it's 7 months. I was chairing a meeting somewhere. And it saved my life. Because there were times in there, because I hadn't had a chance to do the work to heal. And there were times in there that I'm sure I would have drank because I still felt so bad about me. And I was starting to have a realization of what I had done and the people I had harmed. And if it was just me doing the don't drink and go to meetings, I probably would have gotten drunk because I would have been alone by myself thinking. But they had given me the key. And I knew if I got drunk that I wouldn't be there to chair that meeting, because if I drank, I was off to the races. I wouldn't stay sober for me at that point, but I didn't want to let you guys down because you trusted me with the key. And nobody was trusting me with much of anything at that point. Now, I didn't understand that there were other keys, and had I gone and got drunk, they would have had the meeting, because I'm not that important, but when I was new, I was. You know. I'll tell you one quick AA joke. How many alcoholics does it take to change a light bulb? Change? One old-timer said, and I heard one old-timer, I said that to him, he said, oh, it only takes one, but they stand there like this, and they don't move and expect the world to revolve around the light bulb. That's alcoholism, untreated. Anyway. So, I did what they asked me to do, and in spite of me, things got better. At some point, well, when I was new particularly, this is probably the best thing anybody told me. My first sponsor, he said to me, our chips here in Greensboro say, think before you drink, the time to call your sponsor is before, not after. He said, carry that with you, and if you want to take a drink, give me a call. If it makes sense, I'll go get drunk with you. And I was so nuts my first 90 days. There were three times when the crisis du jour had me so wound up that I got it. And I was going to call Larry up, and we were going to go get drunk. And I really thought I was going to convince him because I had a good enough reason. Like he'd said, that's what I needed. And I'd call him up, and in 5 minutes, he'd have me laughing. I'd be thinking, what the hell was I thinking? And if I hadn't have called him, I guarantee I'd have got drunk every time. And I wouldn't be standing here. I don't know how close I came to dying from this disease, but I came pretty close, I'm pretty sure. When I had enough time, I was chairing meetings, and I think that was a big thing too. They had me chairing meetings for 7 straight months. And what happened was people in the program saw me taking action, making an effort to stay sober. Up until that point, I hadn't done that. And I'm mad because no one's helping me. Well, there's a finite number of minutes in the day, and there's a finite number of things people can do, and there's a lot of people that need help. And I kind of understand why they offered it to me, but they weren't going to break their necks when I was not displaying any willingness to take any actions any different other than don't drink and go to meetings. So, I don't know, I just kept doing the deal. I did what they asked me to do. It's like when I pick my chips up now, how'd you do it? Everybody says, one day at a time. I say, I just follow the directions. I quit trying to figure it out. I'm real smart, but I ain't gonna outsmart this disease. I ain't never seen anybody outsmart this disease. In fact, one guy, I remember when I was in that fringe dweller period, come up to me and he said, Boyd, you might be too smart for this program. And I said, thank you. And he went, that wasn't a compliment, you dumbass. He said, I've seen lots of people that were too smart that died drunk. I ain't never seen anybody too dumb to get sober. Pissed me off. But when I'd surrendered, he helped me. He was one of the people that would help me. All right, I'm running out of time. I got to tell one Ray story. Because this is, to me, this is AA. I was at Fernwood on Monday night. And I had probably a little less than a year, I think. This guy comes in there, and to this day, 23 years later, this is the worst looking guy I've ever seen in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I mean, he was splotchy, he was like this. He had handlers, two handlers, one on each side. So he's sitting during the meeting, shaking. Anyway, so the meeting gets done, we get up to say the prayer. I think we got Our Father Who Art out. And bam, crash, boom, the guy had an alcoholic seizure right there in the meeting. Freak me out. But in that meeting there, I think three doctors, 4 or 5 nurse practitioners or physician's assistants, 4 or 5 nurses, other than a hospital, probably the best place to have a seizure. And so I'm standing off to the side. They're working on him. He's trying to swallow his tongue. And I'm like, and then he survived, I think. Ray walks by. And I go, damn, Ray, I ain't never seen nothing like that. Oh, that's just an alcoholic seizure. I've had 3 of them. Everybody ought to have one. And he made me laugh. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous does. When I got here, the stuff that I laughed about today wasn't funny. And it took a while for it to become funny. Early sobriety sucks. There's just no way around it. AA does not work like a fifth of liquor. I would say after about 90 days, I started feeling a lot better. After 6 months, I was feeling a whole lot better. And I think at about 10 months, I'd gone completely through the steps with my sponsor, and I was in another place that I'd never been in before in my life. Because something had happened. I guess I was always trying to be okay by external stuff. If I just had this, if I just had that, if I just had her, just had enough money, if then. And the old timers would tell me, Alcoholics Anonymous in recovery is an inside job. If you do the work, this changes. And when this gets better, that stuff doesn't matter anywhere near as much. Now, don't get me wrong, I still like stuff. But one of the promises in the fifth step is we can be alone at perfect peace and ease. And I could never be alone by myself. Something had to be going on all the time. And I remember when I realized that I could be alone at perfect peace and ease. And there's so many gifts. I could stand up here for another 3 hours and I would not run out of things about the gifts that I've gotten here. I just had to be willing to follow the directions, trust these folks, because I hadn't been willing to do that. In my world, when I was an alcoholic, no one did anything for anyone, myself included, unless they were getting something in return. And I didn't understand here they were helping me, and it's true. The man sitting here, I heard him say it when I was a little over a year sober. He said, I owe this program everything. I owe my life. And the harder I try to pay it back, the deeper in debt I get. That is not the way my world worked when I was in active alcoholism, and today it is. And that, to me, is what recovery is all about. The alcohol truly was a symptom. I needed a lot more than putting that down. I needed something that could heal my soul because the alcohol was tearing it out of me. And I'm grateful that they were patient with me when I was still fighting and wasn't willing to follow directions. I'm grateful for you to listen to me. Thanks.